Complete description of a human being, all the billions of cells, how they are interconnected, all the chemicals and molecules they contain, their biochemical state, consists of far too much information for any computer to handle.
It's just information, Gordon said, shrugging.
Yes, too much information.
We compress it by using a lossless fractal algorithm.
Even so, it's still an enormous...
Excuse me, Chris said. Are you saying you compress a person? No, we compress the information equivalent of a person.
And how is that done? Chris said.
With compression algorithms, methods to pack data on a computer so they take up less space. Like JPEG and MPEG for visual material. Are you familiar with those?
I've got software that uses it, but that's it.
Okay, Gordon said. All compression programs work the same way. They look for similarities in data. Suppose you have a picture of a rose made up of a million pixels. Each pixel has a location and a color. That's 3 million pieces of information, a lot of data. But most of those pixels are going to be red, surrounded by other red pixels. So the program scans the picture line by line and sees whether adjacent pixels are the same color. If they are, it writes an instruction to the computer that says, make this pixel red, and also the next 50 pixels in the line, then switch to gray and make the next 10 pixels gray, and so on. It doesn't store information for each individual point. It stores instructions for how to recreate the picture, and the data is cut to a tenth of what it was.
Even so, Stern said, you're not talking about a two-dimensional picture. You're talking about a three-dimensional living object, and its description requires so much data
that you'd need massive parallel processing, Gordon said, nodding. That's true.
Chris frowned. Parallel processing is what?
You hook several computers together and divide the job up among them so it gets done faster. A big parallel processing computer would have 16,000 processors hooked together. For a really big one, 32,000 processors. We have 32 billion processors hooked together.
Billion? Chris said. Stern leaned forward. That's impossible. Even if you tried to make one.
He stared at the roof of the car, calculating.
Say, allow 1 inch between motherboards. That makes a stack, 2,600. That makes a stack half a mile high. Even reconfigured into a cube, it'd be a huge building. You'd never build it. You'd never cool it. And it'd never work anyway because the processors would end up too far apart.
Gordon sat and smiled.
He was looking at Stern, waiting. The only possible way to do that much processing, Stern said, would be to use the quantum characteristics of individual electrons. But then you'd be talking about a quantum computer, and no one's ever made one.
Gordon just smiled.
Have they? Stern said.
Let me explain what David is talking about, Gordon said to the others. Ordinary computers make calculations using two electron states, which are designated 1 and 0. That's how all computers work, by pushing around 1s and 0s. But 20 years ago, Richard Feynman suggested it might be possible to make an extremely powerful computer using all 32 quantum states of an electron. Many laboratories are now trying to build these quantum computers. Their advantage is unimaginably great power. So great that you can indeed describe and compress a three-dimensional living object into an electron stream, exactly like a fax. You can then transmit the electron stream through a quantum foam wormhole and reintroduce it in another universe. And that's what we do. It's not quantum teleportation. It's not particle entanglement. It's direct transmission to another universe.
The group was silent, staring at him. The Land Cruiser came into a clearing. They saw a number of two-story buildings, brick and glass. They looked surprisingly ordinary. This could be any one of those small industrial parks that were found on the outskirts of any American city. Merrick said, "This is ITC?"
"We like to keep a low profile," Gordon said. "Actually, we chose this spot because there is an old mine here. Good minds are getting hard to find. So many physics projects require them."
Off to one side, working in the glare of floodlights, several men were getting ready to launch a weather balloon. The balloon was 6 feet in diameter, pale white. As they watched, it moved swiftly up into the sky, a small instrument bundle hanging beneath. Merrick said, "What's that about?"
"We monitor the cloud cover every hour, especially when it's stormy. It's an ongoing research project to see if the weather is the cause of any interference."
"Interference with what?" Merrick asked. The car pulled up in front of the largest building. A security guard opened the door. "Welcome to ITC," he said with a big smile. "Mr. Doniger is waiting for you." Doniger walked quickly down the hallway with Gordon. Kramer followed behind. As he walked, Doniger scanned a sheet of paper that listed everybody's names and backgrounds. "How do they look, John?"
"Better than I expected. They're in good physical shape. They know the area. They know the time period."
"And how much persuading will they need?"
"I think they're ready. You just have to be careful talking about the risks."
"Are you suggesting I should be less than entirely honest?" Doniger said.
"Just be careful how you put it," Gordon said. "They're very bright."
"Are they? Well, let's have a look." And he threw the door open. Kate and the others had been left alone in a plain, bare conference room, scratched formica table, folding chairs all around. On one side was a large marker board with formulas scrawled on it. The formulas were so long that they ran the entire width of the board. It was completely mysterious to her. She was about to ask Stern what the formulas were for when Robert Doniger swept into the room. Kate was surprised by how young he was. He didn't look much older than they were, especially dressed in sneakers, jeans, and a quicksilver T-shirt. Even in the middle of the night, he seemed full of energy, going around the table quickly, shaking hands with each of them, addressing them by name. "Kate," he said, smiling at her. "Good to meet you. I've read your preliminary study on the chapel. It's very impressive." Surprised, she managed to say, "Thank you," but Doniger had already moved on. "And Chris, it's nice to see you again. I like the computer simulation approach to that mill bridge. I think it will pay off." Chris had time only to nod before Doniger was saying, "And David Stern, we haven't met, but I gather you're also a physicist, as I am." "That's right. Welcome aboard. And Andre, not getting any shorter. Your paper on the tournaments of Edward I certainly set Monsieur Contamine straight. Good work. So, please, all of you, please, sit down." They sat, and Doniger moved to the head of the table. "I will get right to the point," Doniger said. "I need your help, and I will tell you why. For the last 10 years, my company has been developing a revolutionary new technology. It is not a technology of war, nor is it a commercial technology to be sold for profit. On the contrary, it is an entirely benign and peaceful technology that will provide a great benefit to mankind, a great benefit. But I need your help." "Consider for a moment," Doniger continued, "how unevenly technology has impacted the various fields of knowledge in the 20th century. Physics employs the most advanced technology, including accelerator rings many miles in diameter. The same with chemistry and biology. 100 years ago, Faraday and Maxwell had tiny private labs. Darwin worked with a notebook and a microscope. But today, no important scientific discovery could be made with such simple tools. The sciences are utterly dependent on advanced technology. But what about the humanities? During the same time, what has happened to them?" Doniger paused, rhetorically. "The answer is nothing. There has been no significant technology. The scholar of literature or history works exactly as his predecessors did 100 years before. Oh, there have been some minor changes in authentication of documents and the use of CD-ROMs and so forth, but the basic day-to-day work of the scholar is exactly the same." He looked at each of them in turn. "So we have an inequity. The fields of human knowledge are unbalanced. Medieval scholars are proud that in the 20th century, their views have undergone a revolution. But physics has undergone 3 revolutions in the same century. 100 years ago, physicists argued about the age of the universe and the source of the sun's energy. No one on Earth knew the answers. Today, every school child knows. Today, we have seen the length and breadth of the universe. We understand it from the level of galaxies to the level of subatomic particles. We have learned so much that we can speak in detail about what happened during the first few minutes of the birth of the exploding universe. Can medieval scholars match this advance within their own field? In a word, no. Why not? Because no new technology assists them. No one has ever developed a new technology for the benefit of historians. Until now. A masterful performance, Gordon thought. One of Doniger's best. Charming, energetic, even excessive at moments. Yet the fact was, Doniger had just given them an exciting explanation for the project without ever revealing its true purpose. Without ever telling them what was really going on. But I told you I needed your help, and I do. Doniger's mood changed. He spoke slowly now, somber, concerned. You know that Professor Johnston came here to see us because he thought we were withholding information, and in a way we were. We did have certain information that we hadn't shared because we couldn't explain how we got it. And, Gordon thought, because Kramer screwed up. Professor Johnston pushed us, Doniger was saying. I'm sure you know his way. He even threatened to go to the press. Finally, we showed him the technology we are about to show you, and he was excited, just as you will be. But he insisted on going back to see for himself. Doniger paused. We didn't want him to go. Again, he threatened. In the end, we had no choice but to let him go back. That was 3 days ago. He is still back there. He asked you for help in a message he knew you would find. You know that site and time better than anyone else in the world. You have to go back and get him. You are his only chance.
What exactly happened to him after he went back? Merrick said.
We don't know, Doniger said. But he broke the rules.
Rules?
You have to understand that this technology is still very new. We've been cautious about how we use it. We have been sending observers back for about 2 years now, using ex-Marines, trained military people. But of course they are not historians, and we have kept them on a tight leash.
Meaning what?
We haven't ever let our observers enter the world back there. We haven't allowed anyone to stay longer than an hour, and we haven't allowed anyone to go more than 50 yards from the machine. Nobody has ever just left the machine behind and gone off into the world.
But the professor did, Merrick said.
He must have, yes.
And we'll have to, too, if we're going to find him. We'll have to enter the world.
Yes,
Doniger said. And you're saying we're the first people ever to do this? The first people ever to step into the world?
Yes, you and the professor before you.
Silence.
Suddenly, Merrick broke into a broad grin.
Terrific, he said. I can't wait.
But the others said nothing. They looked uneasy, edgy.
Stern said, about this guy they found in the desert?
Joe Traub, Doniger said. He was one of our best scientists. What was he doing in the desert?
Apparently he drove there. They found his car, but we don't know why he went.
Stern said, supposedly he was all messed up. There was something about his fingers.
That wasn't in the autopsy report, Doniger said. He died of a heart attack.
Then his death had nothing to do with your technology?
Nothing at all. Doniger said. There was another silence. Chris shifted in his chair.
In layman's terms, how safe is this technology?
Safer than driving your car, Doniger said without hesitation. You will be thoroughly briefed and we'll send you back with our experienced observers. The trip will last a maximum of 2 hours. You'll just go back and get him.
Chris Hughes drummed his fingers on the table. Kate bit her lip. Nobody spoke.
Look, this is all voluntary, Doniger said. It's entirely up to you whether you go or not. But the professor has asked for your help, and I don't think you would let him down.
Why don't you just send the observers? Stern said.
Because they don't know enough, David. As you're aware, it's an entirely different world back there.
You have the advantage of your knowledge. You know the site, and you know the time in detail. You know languages and customs.
But our knowledge is academic, Chris said.
Not anymore, Doniger said.
The group filed out of the room, heading off with Gordon to see the machines. Doniger watched them go, then turned as Kramer entered the room. She had been watching everything on the closed-circuit television.
"What do you think, Diane?" Doniger said. "Will they go?"
"Yeah, they'll go."
"Can they pull it off?"
Kramer paused.
"I'd say it's 50-50.
They walked down a broad concrete ramp, large enough for a truck to drive down. At the bottom was a pair of heavy steel doors. Merrick saw a half dozen security cameras mounted in different locations around the ramp. The cameras turned, following them as they walked down to the doors. At the bottom of the ramp, Gordon looked up at the security cameras and waited. The doors opened. Gordon led them through into a small room beyond. The steel doors clanged shut behind them. Gordon went forward to an inner set of doors, again waited. Merrick said,
"You can't open them yourself?"
"No."
"Why? They don't trust you?"
"They don't trust anybody," Gordon said. "Believe me, nobody gets in here unless we intend for them to get in."
The doors opened. They walked into an industrial-looking metal cage. The air was cold, faintly musty. The doors closed behind them. With a whirr, the cage began to descend.
Merrick saw that they were standing in an elevator.
"We're going down 1,000 feet, Gordon said. "Be patient."
The elevator stopped and the doors opened. They walked down a long concrete tunnel, their footsteps echoing. Gordon said,
"This is the control and maintenance level. The actual machines are another 500 feet below us."
They came to a pair of heavy doors that were dark blue and transparent. At first, Merrick thought they were made of extremely thick glass, but as the doors slid open on a motorized track, he saw slight movement beneath the surface.
"Water," Gordon said. "We use a lot of water shielding here. Quantum technology is very sensitive to random outside influences, cosmic rays, spurious electronic fields, all of that. That's why we're down here in the first place."
Up ahead, they saw what appeared to be the doors to an ordinary laboratory hallway. Passing through another set of glass doors, they entered a hallway painted antiseptic white, with doors opening off on either side. The first door on the left said, "Pre-pack." The second, "Field prep." And further down the hallway, they saw a sign marked simply, "Transit." Gordon rubbed his hands together. He said,
"Let's get right to the packing."
The room was small and reminded Merrick of a hospital laboratory. It made him uneasy. In the center of the room stood a vertical tube, about 7 feet high and 5 feet in diameter. It was hinged open. Inside were dull strips. Merrick said,
"A sun tanning machine?"
"Actually, it's an advanced resonance imager. Basically, it's a high-powered MRI. But you'll find it's good practice for the machine itself. Perhaps you should go first, Dr. Merrick."
"Go in there?"
Merrick pointed to the tube. Seen up close, it looked more like a white coffin.
"Just remove your clothes and step inside. It's exactly like an MRI. You won't feel anything at all. The entire process takes about a minute. We'll be next door."
They went through a side door with a small window into another room. Merrick couldn't see what was in there. The door clanged shut. He saw a chair in the corner. He went over and took his clothes off, then walked into the scanner. There was the click of an intercom, and he heard Gordon say,
"Dr. Merrick, if you will look at your feet."
Merrick looked down at his feet.
"You see the circle on the floor? Please make sure your feet are entirely within that circle."
Merrick shifted his position.
"Thank you. That's fine. The door will close now."
With a mechanical hum, the hinged door swung shut. Merrick heard a hiss as it sealed. He said,
"Airtight?"
"Yes, it has to be. You may feel some cold air coming in now. We'll give you added oxygen while we calibrate. You're not claustrophobic, are you?"
"I wasn't until now."
Merrick was looking around at the interior. The dull strips he now saw were plastic-covered openings. Behind the plastic he saw lights, small whirring machines. The air became noticeably cooler.
"We're calibrating now," Gordon said. "Try not to move."
Suddenly, the individual strips around him began to rotate, the machines clicking. The strips spun faster and faster, then suddenly jerked to a stop.
"That's good. Feel all right?"
"It's like being inside a pepper mill," Merrick said.
Gordon laughed.
"Calibration is completed. The rest is dependent on exact timing, so the sequence is automatic. Just follow the instructions as you hear them, okay?
Okay. A click. Merrick was alone. A recorded voice said, "The scan sequence has begun. We are turning on lasers. Look straight ahead, and do not look up." Instantly, the interior of the tube was a bright glowing blue. The air itself seemed to be glowing. Lasers are polarizing the xenon gas, which is now being pumped into the compartment. 5 seconds. Merrick thought, xenon gas? The bright blue color all around him increased in intensity. He looked down at his hand and could hardly see it for the shimmering air. "We have reached xenon concentration. Now we will ask you to take a deep breath." Merrick thought, "Take a deep breath of xenon? Hold your position without moving for 30 seconds. Ready? Stand still. Eyes open. Deep breath. Hold it. Now." The strip suddenly began to spin wildly. Then one by one, each strip started to jerk back and forth, almost as if it were looking, and sometimes had to go back for a second look. Each strip seemed to be moving individually. Merrick had the uncanny sense of being examined by hundreds of eyes. The recorded voice said, "Very still, please. 20 seconds remaining." All around him, the strips hummed and whirred, and then suddenly they all stopped. Several seconds of silence. The machinery clicked. Now they began to move forward and back, as well as laterally. "Very still, please. 10 seconds. They began to spin in circles now, slowly synchronizing until finally they were all rotating together as a unit. Then they stopped. "The scan is completed. Thank you for your cooperation." The blue light clicked off, and the hinge door hissed open. Merrick stepped out. In the adjacent room, Gordon sat in front of a computer console. The others had pulled up chairs around him. "Most people," Gordon said, "don't realize that the ordinary hospital MRI works by changing the quantum state of atoms in your body, generally the angular momentum of nuclear particles. Experience with MRIs tells us that changing your quantum state has no ill effect. In fact, you don't even notice it happening. But the ordinary MRI does this with a very powerful magnetic field, say 1.5 Tesla, about 25,000 times as strong as the Earth's magnetic field. We don't need that. We use superconducting quantum interference devices, or SQUIDs, that are so sensitive they can measure resonance just from the Earth's magnetic field. We don't have any magnets in there." Merrick came into the room. "How do I look?" he said. The image on the screen showed a translucent picture of Merrick's limbs in speckled red. "You're looking at the marrow, inside the long bones, the spine, and the skull," Gordon said. "Now it builds outward by organ systems. Here's the bones." They saw a complete skeleton. "And now we're adding muscles." Watching the organ systems appear, Stern said, "Your computer's incredibly fast." "Oh, we've slowed this way down," Gordon said. "Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see it happening. The actual processing time is essentially zero." Stern stared. "Zero?" "Different world," Gordon said, nodding. "Old assumptions don't apply." He turned to the others. "Who's next?" They walked down to the end of the corridor to the room marked Transit. Kate said, "Why did we just do all that?" "We call it pre-packing," Gordon said. "It enables us to transmit faster, because most of the information about you is already loaded into the machine. We just do a final scan for differences, and then we transmit." They entered another elevator and passed through another set of water-filled doors. "Okay," Gordon said. "Here we are." They came into an enormous, brightly lit, cavernous space. Sounds echoed. The air was cold. They were walking on a metal passageway, suspended 100 feet above the floor. Looking down, Chris saw 3 semicircular, water-filled walls, arranged to form a circle, with gaps between large enough for a person to walk through. Inside this outer wall were 3 smaller semicircles, forming a second wall. And inside the second wall was a third. Each successive semicircle was rotated so that the gaps never lined up, giving the whole thing a maze-like appearance. In the center of the concentric circles was a space about 20 feet across.
Here, half a dozen cage-like devices stood, each about the size of a phone booth. They were arranged in no particular pattern. They had dull-colored metal tops. White mist drifted across the enclosure. Tanks lay on the floor and heavy black power cables snaked everywhere. It looked like a workroom, and in fact, some men were working on one of the cages.
"This is our transmission area," Gordon said, "heavily shielded, as you can see. We're building a second area over there, but it won't be ready for several months."
He pointed across the cavernous space, where a second series of concentric walls were going up. These walls were clear. They hadn't been filled with water yet. From the gangway, a cable elevator went down to the space in the center of the glass walls. Merrick said, "Can we go down there?"
"Not yet. No."
A technician looked up and waved. Gordon said,
"How long until the burn check, Norm?"
"Couple of minutes. Gomez is on her way now."
"Okay."
Gordon turned to the others.
"Let's go up to the control booth to watch."
Bathed in deep blue light, the machines stood on a raised platform. They were dull gray in color and hummed softly. White vapor seeped along the floor, obscuring their bases. Two workmen in blue parkas were down on their hands and knees, working inside the open base of one of them. The machines were essentially open cylinders, with metal at the top and bottom. Each machine stood on a thick metal base. Three rods around the perimeter supported the metal roof. Technicians were dragging a tangle of black cables down from an overhead grid, and then attaching the cables to the roof of one machine, like gas station attendants filling a car. The space between the base and the roof was completely empty. In fact, the whole machine seemed disappointingly plain. The rods were odd, triangular-shaped, and studded along their length. Pale blue smoke seemed to be coming from under the roof of the machine. The machines didn't look like anything Kate had ever seen. She stared at the huge screens inside the narrow control room. Behind her, two technicians in shirt sleeves sat at two console desks. The screens in front of her gave the impression you were looking out a window, though in fact the control room was windowless.
"You are looking at the latest version of our CTC technology," Gordon said. "That stands for Closed Time-Like Curve, the topology of space-time that we employ to go back. We've had to develop entirely new technologies to build these machines. What you see here is actually the sixth version, since the first working prototype was built 3 years ago."
Chris stared at the machines and said nothing. Kate Erickson was looking around the control room. Stern was anxious, rubbing his upper lip. Merrick kept his eye on Stern.
"All the significant technology," Gordon continued, "is located in the base, including the indium gallium arsenide quantum memory, the computer lasers, and the battery cells. The vaporizing lasers, of course, are in the metal strips. The dull-colored metal is niobium. Pressure tanks are aluminum. Storage elements are polymer."
A young woman with short dark red hair and a tough manner walked into the room. She wore a khaki shirt, shorts, and boots. She looked as if she were dressed for a safari.
"Gomez will be one of your aides when you go take your trip. She's going back right now to do what we call a burn check. She's already burned her navigation marker, fixing the target date, and now she's going to make sure it's accurate."
He pushed the intercom.
"Sue, show us your nav marker, would you?"
The woman held up a white rectangular wafer, hardly larger than a postage stamp. She cupped it easily in her palm.
"She'll use that to go back and to call the machine for the return. Show us the button, would you, Sue?"
"It's a little hard to see," she said, turning the wafer on edge. "There's a tiny button here. You push it with your thumbnail. That calls the machine when you're ready to go back."
"Thank you, Sue."
One of the technicians said, "Field, Buck." They turned and looked. On his console, one screen showed an undulating three-dimensional surface with a jagged upswinging in the middle, like a mountain peak.
"Nice one," Gordon said. "Classic."
He explained to the others,
"Because our field sensing equipment is squid-based, we're able to detect extremely subtle discontinuities in the local magnetic field. We call them field bucks. We'll register them starting as early as 2 hours before an event. And in fact, these started about 2 hours ago. It means a machine is returning here."
What machine? Kate said.
Sue's machine.
But she hasn't left yet.
I know, he said. It doesn't seem to make sense. Quantum events are all counterintuitive.
You're saying you get an indicator that she is returning before she has left?
Yes.
Why? Kate said.
Gordon sighed. It's complicated. Actually, what we are seeing in the field is a probability function, the likelihood that a machine is going to return. We don't usually think about it that way. We just say it's coming back. But to be accurate, a field buck is really telling us that it is highly probable a machine is coming back.
Kate was shaking her head. I don't get it.
Gordon said, let's just say that in the ordinary world, we have beliefs about cause and effect. Causes occur first, effects second. But that order of events does not always occur in the quantum world. Effects can be simultaneous with causes, and effects can precede causes. This is one minor example of that.
The woman, Gomez, stepped into one of the machines. She pushed the white wafer into a slot in the base in front of her.
She's just installed her nav marker, which guides the machine out and back.
And how do you know you'll get back? Stern said.
A multiverse transfer, Gordon said, creates a sort of potential energy, like a stretched spring that wants to snap back, so the machines can home relatively easily. Outbound is the tricky part. That's what's encoded in the ceramic.
He leaned forward to press an intercom button.
Sue, how long are you gone?
I'll be a minute, maybe two.
Okay. Sync elapsed.
Now the technicians began to talk, flipping switches at a console, looking at video readouts in front of them. Helium check. Red is full, she said, looking at her console. EMR check. Check. Stand by for laser alignment. One of the technicians flipped a switch, and from the metal strips, a dense array of green lasers fired into the center of the machine, putting dozens of green spots on her face and body as she stood still, her eyes closed. The bars began to revolve slowly. The woman in the center remained still. The lasers made green horizontal streaks over her body. Then the bars stopped. Lasers aligned, Gordon said.
See you in a minute, Sue.
He turned to the others.
Okay. Here we go.
The curved water shields around the cage began to glow a faint blue. Once again, the machine began to rotate slowly. The woman in the center stood motionless. The machine moved around her. The humming grew louder. The rotation increased in speed. The woman stood, calm and relaxed.
For this trip, Gordon said, she'll use up only a minute or two. But she actually has 37 hours in her battery cells. That's the limit these machines can remain in a location without returning.
The bars were spinning swiftly. They now heard a rapid chattering sound like a machine gun.
That's the clearance check. Infrared sensors verify the space around the machine. They won't proceed without 2 meters on all sides. They check both ways. It's a safety measure. We wouldn't want the machine emerging in the middle of a stone wall. All right. They're releasing xenon. Here she goes.
The humming was now very loud. The enclosure spun so rapidly the metal strips were blurred. They could see the woman inside quite clearly. They heard a recorded voice say,
stand still, eyes open, deep breath, hold it, now.
From the top of the machine, a single ring descended, scanning quickly to her feet.
Now watch closely. It's fast, Gordon said.
Kate saw deep violet lasers fire inward from all the bars towards the center. The woman inside seemed to glow white hot for an instant, and then a burst of blinding white light flashed inside the machine. Kate closed her eyes, turned away. When she looked back, there were spots in front of her eyes, and for a moment she couldn't see what had happened. Then she realized that the machine was smaller. It had pulled away from the cables at the top, which now dangled free. Another laser flash. The machine was smaller. The woman inside was smaller. She was now only about 3 feet high and shrinking before their eyes in a series of bright laser flashes.
Jesus, Stern said, watching. What does that feel like?
Nothing, Gordon said. You don't feel a thing. Nerve conduction time from skin to brain is on the order of 100 milliseconds.
Laser vaporization is 5 nanoseconds. You're long gone. But she's still there.
No, she's not. She was gone in the first laser burst. The computer's just processing the data now. What you see is an artifact of compression stepping. The compression's about 3 to the -2.
There was another bright flash. The cage now shrank rapidly. It was 3 feet high, then 2. Now it was close to the floor, less than 1 foot tall. The woman inside looked like a little doll in khakis.
-4, Gordon said.
There was another bright burst near the floor. Now Kate couldn't see the cage at all.
What happened to it?
It's there. Barely. Another burst. This time just a pinpoint flash on the floor.
-5.
The flashes came more quickly now, winking like a firefly, diminishing in strength. Gordon counted them out. And -14. Gone. There were no more flashes. Nothing. The cage had vanished. The floor was dark rubber, empty. Kate said,
"We're supposed to do that?"
"It's not an unpleasant experience," Gordon said. "You're entirely conscious all the way down, which is something we can't explain. By the final data compressions, you're in very small domains, subatomic regions, and consciousness should not be possible. Yet it occurs. We think it may be an artifact, a hallucination that bridges the transition. If so, it's analogous to the phantom limb that amputees feel, even though the limb isn't there. This may be a kind of phantom brain. Of course, we are talking about very brief time periods, nanoseconds, but nobody understands consciousness anyway." Kate was frowning. For some time now, she had been looking at what she saw as architecture, a kind of form-follows-function approach. Wasn't it remarkable how these huge underground structures had concentric symmetry, slightly reminiscent of medieval castles, even though these modern structures had been built without any aesthetic plan at all? They had simply been built to solve a scientific problem. She found the resulting appearance fascinating. But now she was confronted by what these machines were actually used for. She struggled to make sense of what her eyes had just seen. And her architectural training was absolutely no help to her. But this, method of shrinking a person, it requires you to break her down?
No. We destroy her, Gordon said bluntly. You have to destroy the original so that it can be reconstructed at the other end. You can't have one without the other.
So she actually died?
I wouldn't say that. No.
You see, but if you destroy the person at one end, Kate said, don't they die?
Gordon sighed. It's difficult to think of this in traditional terms, he said. Since you're instantaneously reconstructed at the very moment you are destroyed, how can you be said to have died? You haven't died. You've just moved somewhere else.
Stern felt certain it was a visceral sense in the pit of his stomach that Gordon wasn't being entirely honest about this technology. Just looking at the curved water shields, at all the different machines standing on the floor, gave him the sense that there was quite a bit more that was being left unexplained. He tried to find it. So she is in the other universe now? He asked.
That's right.
You transmitted her, and she arrived in the other universe, just like a fax.
Exactly.
But to rebuild her, you need a fax machine at the other end. Gordon shook his head.
No, you don't, he said.
Why not?
Because she's already there.
Stern frowned. She's already there? How could that be?
At the moment of transmission, the person is already in the other universe, and therefore the person doesn't need to be rebuilt by us.
Why? Stern said.
For now, just call it a characteristic of the multiverse. We can discuss it later if you like. I'm not sure everybody needs to be bothered with these details, he said, nodding to the others.
Stern thought there is something more, something he doesn't want to say to us. Stern looked back at the transmission area, trying to find the odd detail, the thing that was out of place, because he was sure that something here was out of place. Didn't you tell us that you've only sent a few people back?
That's right.
Yes. More than one at a time?
Almost never. Very rarely, too.
Then why do you have so many machines? Stern said. I'd count 8 in there. Wouldn't 2 be enough?
You're just seeing the results of our research program, Gordon said. We are constantly working to refine our design.
Gordon had answered smoothly enough, but Stern was certain he had seen something, some buried glint of uneasiness in Gordon's eyes. There is definitely something more.
I would have thought, Stern said, that you'd make refinements to the same machines.
Gordon shrugged again, but did not answer.
Definitely.
What are those repairmen doing in there? Stern said, still probing. He pointed to the men on their hands and knees, working on the base of one machine. I mean by the machine in the corner. What exactly are they repairing?
David, Gordon began, I really think...
Is this technology really safe? Stern said.
Gordon sighed.
See for yourself.
On the big screen, a sequence of rapid flashes appeared on the floor of the transit room.
Here she comes, Gordon said.
The flashes grew brighter. They heard the chattering sound again, first faintly, then louder. And then the cage was full size. The humming died away. The ground mist swirled, and the woman climbed out, waving to the spectators. Stern squinted at her. She appeared absolutely fine. Her appearance was identical to what it had been before. Gordon looked at him.
Believe me, he said, it's perfectly safe.
He turned to the screen.
How'd it look back there, Sue?
Excellent, she said. Transit site is on the north side of the river, secluded spot in the woods, and the weather's pretty good for April. She glanced at her watch. Get your team together, Dr. Gordon. I'm going to go burn the spare nav marker. Then let's go back there and pull that old guy out before somebody hurts him.
Lie on your left side, please.
Kate rolled over on the table and watched uneasily as an elderly man in a white lab coat raised what looked like a glue gun and placed it over her ear.
This will feel warm.
Warm? She felt a burning rush of heat in her ear.
What is that?
It's an organic polymer, the man said. Non-toxic and non-allergenic. Give it 8 seconds.
All right, now please make chewing motions. We want a looser fit. Very good. Keep chewing.
She heard him going down the line. Chris was on the table behind her, then Stern, then Merrick. She heard the old man say,
Lie on your left side, please. This will feel warm.
Not long after, he was back. He made her turn over and injected the hot polymer into her other ear. Gordon was watching from the corner of the room. He said,
This is still a bit experimental, but so far it works quite well. It's made of a polymer that begins to biodegrade after a week.
Later, the man made them stand up. He expertly popped the plastic implants out of their ears, then moved on down the line. Kate said to Gordon,
My hearing is fine. I don't need a hearing aid.
It's not a hearing aid, Gordon said.
Across the room, the man was drilling out the center of the plastic earpieces and inserting electronics. He worked surprisingly quickly. When the electronics were in place, he capped the hole with more plastic.
It's a machine language translator and a radio mic, in case you need to understand what people are saying to you.
But even if I understand what they're saying, she said, how can I answer back?
Merrick nudged her. Don't worry. I speak Occitan and Middle French.
Oh, that's good, she said sarcastically. You going to teach it to me in the next 15 minutes?
She was tense. She was about to be destroyed or vaporized or whatever the hell they did in that machine, and the words just popped out of her mouth.
Merrick looked surprised.
No, he said seriously. But if you stay with me, I will take care of you.
Something about his earnestness reassured her. He was such a straight arrow. She thought, he probably will take care of me. She felt herself relaxing.
Soon after, they were all fitted with flesh-colored plastic earpieces.
They're turned off now, Gordon said. To turn them on, just tap your ear with your finger. Now, if you'll come over here.
Gordon handed them each a small leather pouch.
We've been working on a first aid kit. These are the prototypes. You're the first to enter the world, so you may have a use for them. You can keep them out of sight under your clothing.
He opened one pouch and brought out a small aluminum canister about 4 inches high and 1 inch in diameter. It looked like a little shaving cream can.
This is the only defense we can provide you. It contains 12 doses of ethylene dihydride with a protein substrate.
We can demonstrate for you with the cat, H.G.
Where are you, H.G.?
A black cat jumped onto the table. Gordon stroked it and then shot a burst of gas at its nose. The cat blinked, made a snuffling sound, and fell over on its side.
Unconsciousness within 6 seconds, Gordon said. And it leaves a radioactive amnesia. But bear in mind that it's short-acting, and you must fire right in the person's face to ensure any effect.
The cat was already starting to twitch and revive as Gordon turned back to the pouch and held up 3 red paper cubes, roughly the size of sugar cubes, each covered in a layer of pale wax. They looked like fireworks.
If you need to start a fire, he said, these will do it. Pull the little string and they catch fire. They're marked 15, 30, 60, the number of seconds before the fire starts. Wax, so they're waterproof. A word of warning. Sometimes they don't work.
Chris Hughes said, what's wrong with the Bic?
Not correct for the period. You can't take plastic back there. Gordon returned to the kit. Then we have basic first aid. Nothing fancy. Anti-inflammatory, anti-diarrhea, anti-spasmodic, anti-pain. You don't want to be vomiting in a castle, he said. And we can't give you pills for the water.
Stern took all this in with a sense of unreality. Vomiting in a castle, he thought.
And finally, an all-purpose pocket tool, including knife and picklock.
It looked like a steel Swiss Army knife. Gordon put everything back in the kit.
You'll probably never use any of this stuff, but you've got it anyway. Now let's get you dressed.
Stern could not shake off his persistent sense of unease. A kindly grandmotherly woman had gotten up from her sewing machine and was handing them all clothing. First, white linen undershorts, sort of boxer shorts, but without elastic. Then a leather belt, and then black woolen leggings.
What are these? Stern said.
Tights?
They're called hose, dear.
There was no elastic on them either.
How do they stay up?
You slip them under your belt, beneath the doublet, or tie them to the points of your doublet.
Points?
That's right, dear. Of your doublet. Stern glanced at the others. They were calmly collecting the clothes in a pile as each article was given to them. They seemed to know what everything was for. They were as calm as if they were in a department store. But Stern was lost, and he felt panicky. Now he was given a white linen shirt that came to his upper thigh and a large overshirt called a doublet, made of quilted felt, and finally a dagger on a steel chain. He looked at it askance.
Everyone carries one. You'll need it for eating, if nothing else.
He put it absently on top of the pile and poked through the clothing, still trying to find the points.
Gordon said, these clothes are intended to be status neutral, neither expensive nor poor. We want them to approximate the dress of a middling merchant, a court page, or a down-at-the-heels nobleman.
Stern was handed shoes, which looked like leather slippers with pointed toes, except they buckled, like court jester's shoes, he thought unhappily. The grandmotherly woman smiled.
Don't worry. They have air soles built in, just like your Nikes.
Why is everything dirty? Stern said, frowning at his undershirt.
Well, you want to fit in, don't you?
They changed in a locker room. Stern watched the other men. How exactly do we,
You want to know how you dress in the 14th century? Merrick said. It's simple. Merrick had stripped off all his clothes and was walking naked, relaxed. The man was bulging with muscles. Stern felt intimidated as he slowly took off his trousers. First, Merrick said, put on your undershorts. This is very nice quality linen. They had good linen in those days. To hold the shorts up, tie your belt around your waist and roll the top of the undershorts around the belt a couple of times, so it holds. All right?
Your belt goes under your clothes?
That's right. Holding up your shorts. Next, put on your hose.
Merrick began to pull on his black wool tights. The hose had feet at the bottom, like a child's pajamas.
These had the strings at the top, you see.
My hose is baggy, Stern said, tugging them up, poking at the knees.
That's fine. These aren't dress hose, so they aren't skin tight. Next, your linen overshirt. Just pull it over your head and let it hang down. No, no, David. The slit at the neck goes in the front.
Stern pulled his arms out and twisted the shirt around, fumbling.
And finally, Merrick said, picking up a felt outer shirt, you put on your doublet, combination suit coat and windbreaker. You wear it indoors and out. Never take it off except when it is very hot. See the points? They're the laces under the felt. Now tie your hose to the points of the doublet. Merrick managed this in only a few moments. It was as if he'd done it every day of his life. It took Chris much longer, Stern noted with satisfaction. Stern himself struggled to twist his torso to tie the knots at his backside.
You call this simple?
He said, grunting. You just haven't looked at your own clothes lately, Merrick said. The average Westerner in the 20th century wears 9 to 12 items of daily clothing. Here there are only 6. Stern pulled on his doublet, tugging it down over his waist, so it came to his thighs. In doing so, he wrinkled his undershirt, and eventually Merrick had to help him straighten it all out, as well as lace his hose tighter. Finally, Merrick looped the dagger and the chain loosely around Stern's waist and stood back to admire him. There, Merrick said, nodding. How do you feel? Stern wiggled his shoulders uncomfortably.
I feel like a trussed chicken.
Merrick laughed. You'll get used to it. Kate was finishing dressing when Susan Gomez, the young woman who had taken the trip back, came in. Gomez was wearing period clothes and a wig. She tossed another wig to Kate. Kate made a face. You have to wear it, Gomez said. Short hair on a woman is a sign of disgrace or heresy. Don't ever let anyone back there see your true hair length. Kate pulled on the wig, which brought dark blonde hair to her shoulders. She turned to look in the mirror and saw the face of a stranger. She looked younger, softer, weaker. It's either that, Gomez said, or cut your hair really short like a man. Your call.
I'll wear the wig, Kate said.
Diane Kramer looked at Victor Barreto and said, But this has always been a rule, Victor. You know that.
Yes, but the problem, Barreto said, is that you're giving us a new mission.
Barreto was a lean, tough-looking man in his 30s, an ex-ranger who had been with the company for 2 years. During that time, he had acquired a reputation as a competent security man, but a bit of a prima donna. Now you're asking us to go into the world, but you won't let us take weapons.
That's right, Victor. No anachronisms. No modern artifacts going back. That's been our rule from the beginning.
Kramer tried to conceal her frustration. These military types were difficult, particularly the men. The women, like Gomez, were okay. But the men kept trying to, as they put it, apply their training to the ITC trips back, and it never really worked. Privately, Kramer thought it was just a way for the men to conceal their anxiety, but of course she could never say that. It was difficult enough for them to take orders from a woman like her in the first place. The men also had more trouble keeping their work secret. It was easier for women, but the men all wanted to brag about going back in the past. Of course, they were forbidden by all sorts of contractual arrangements, but contracts could be forgotten after a few drinks in a bar. That was why Kramer had informed them all about the existence of several specially burned nav wafers. These wafers had entered the mythology of the company, including their names: Tunguska, Vesuvius, Tokyo. The Vesuvius wafer puts you on the Bay of Naples at 7 a.m. on August 24th, A.D. 79, just before burning ash killed everyone. Tunguska left you in Siberia in 1908, just before the giant meteor struck, with a shockwave that killed every living thing for hundreds of miles. Tokyo put you in that city in 1923, just before the earthquake flattened it. The idea was if word of the project became public, you might end up with the wrong wafer on your next trip out. None of the military types were quite sure whether any of this was true or just company mythology, which was just how Kramer liked it. This is a new mission, Barreto said again, as if she hadn't heard him before. You're asking us to go into the world, to go behind enemy lines, so to speak, without weapons. But you're all trained in hand-to-hand. You, Gomez, all of you. I don't think that's sufficient. Victor, with all due respect, Ms. Kramer, you're not facing up to the situation here, Barreto said stubbornly. You've already lost 2 people. 3, if you count Traub.
No, Victor, We've never lost anybody. You certainly lost Traub. We didn't lose Dr. Traub, she said. Traub volunteered, and Traub was depressed. You assume he was depressed. We know he was, Victor. After his wife died, he was severely depressed and suicidal. Even though he had passed his trip limit, he wanted to go back to see if he could improve the technology. He had an idea that he could modify the machines to have fewer transcription errors, but apparently his idea was wrong. That's why he ended up in the Arizona desert. Personally, I don't think he ever really intended to come back at all. I think it was suicide. And you lost Rob, Barreto said. He wasn't any damn suicide. Kramer sighed. Rob Deckard was one of the first of the observers to go back, almost 2 years earlier, and he was one of the first to show transcription errors. That was much earlier in the project, Victor. The technology was less refined, and you know what happened. After he'd made several trips, Rob began to show minor effects. He insisted on continuing, but we didn't lose him. He went out, and he never came back, Barreto said. That's the bottom line. Rob knew exactly what he was doing. And now the professor. We haven't lost the professor, she said. He's still alive. You hope. And you don't know why he didn't come back in the first place. Victor, I'm just saying, Barreto said, in this case, the logistics don't fit the mission profile. You're asking us to take an unnecessary risk. You don't have to go, Kramer said mildly. No, hell, I never said that. You don't have to. No, I'm going. Well, then, those are the rules. No modern technology goes into the world. Understood? Understood. And none of this gets mentioned to the academics. No, no, hell no. I'm professional. Okay, Kramer said. She watched him leave. He was sulking, but he was going to go along with it. They always did in the end. And the rule was important, she thought. Even though Doniger liked to give a little speech about how you couldn't change history, the fact was nobody really knew, and nobody wanted to risk it. They didn't want modern weapons, or artifacts, or plastic to go back. And they never had. Stern sat with the others on hard-back chairs in a room with maps. Susan Gomez, the woman who had just returned in the machine, spoke in a crisp, quick manner that Stern found rushed. We are going, she said, to the monastery de Sainte-Mère on the Dordogne River in southwestern France. We will arrive at 8:04 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, April 7, 1357. That's the day of the professor's message. It's fortunate for us because there's a tournament that day in Castelgar, and the spectacle will draw large crowds from the surrounding countryside, so we won't be noticed. She tapped one map. Just for orientation, the monastery is here. Castelgar is over here, across the river. And the fortress of La Roque is on the bluffs here, above the monastery. Questions so far? They shook their heads. All right. The situation in the area is a little unsettled. As you know, April of 1357 puts us roughly 20 years into the Hundred Years' War. It's 7 months after the English victory at Poitiers, where they took the King of France prisoner. The French king is now being held for ransom, and France, without a king, is in an uproar. Right now, Castelgar is in the hands of Sir Oliver de Vannes, a British knight born in France. Oliver has taken over La Roque, where he is strengthening the castle's defenses. Sir Oliver is an unpleasant character, with a famously bad temper. They call him the Butcher of Crecy for his excesses in that battle. So Oliver is in control of both towns, Merrick said. At the moment, yes. However, a company of renegade knights, led by a defrocked priest called Arnaud de Cerveau, the archpriest, Merrick said. Yes, exactly, the archpriest, is moving into the area and will undoubtedly attempt to take the castles from Oliver. We believe the archpriest is still several days away, but fighting may break out at any time, so we will work quickly. She moved to another map with larger scale. It showed the monastery buildings. We will arrive approximately here, at the edge of the Forêt de Sainte-Mère. From our arrival point, we should be able to look right down on the monastery. Since the professor's message came from the monastery, we will go directly there first. As you know, the monastery takes its main meal of the day at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the professor is likely to be present at that time. With luck, we'll find him there and bring him back. Merrick said, How do you know all this? I thought nobody's ever gone into the world. That's correct. No one has.
but observers close to the machines have still brought back enough that we know the background at this particular time. Any other questions? They shook their heads, no. All right. It is very important we recover the professor while he is still at the monastery. If he moves to either Castelgar or La Roque, it will be much more difficult. We have a tight mission profile.